Coming up on Tech Nation, Gary Shapiro, the longtime president and CEO of CTA, the Consumer Technology Association. You know him from his book, Ninja Innovation. He'll tell us about what's coming up at CES 2017 in Las Vegas. Then on Biotech Nation, Dr. Steve Mento from Conatus Pharmaceuticals tells us about their efforts to treat NASH, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And Bill Newell, the CEO of Sutro Biopharma, fills us in on their strategic approach to treating cancer. Their first target, B-cell lymphomas. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
I'm falling behind, not carrying my weight, so to speak. Or at the very least, I'm bringing down the average. I've just read that Americans listen to music 4 hours each day, and I listen to music mostly 0 hours a day. If I'm in the car, I listen to audiobooks. If I'm on a plane, then it's the iPad and puzzles until we get to cruising altitude, and my laptop can leap into the fray. I'm just not doing my fair share, and that means others have to listen to a lot more music to make up the difference. According to Nielsen's 2014 Music 360 survey, 93% of Americans voluntarily listen to 25 hours per week of music. I say voluntarily because surely they can't be counting that stuff that goes on in elevators or the background tunes you might find in a hotel lobby or at a party. Yet I'm willing to bet that some people listening to me right now are shocked that I'm shocked. They had to voluntarily stop listening to music to make time to listen to me, or rather, my guests, since they're actually the main attraction. Truth be told, there's a reason I don't listen to all that much music, and it has to do with my brain. If there's music going on, I listen to the music, and my brain stops working on anything else. Some part of my brain starts protesting. Hey, I'm trying to work here, or just think. What's all this music going on? I always thought it was similar to my friend Maggie. If she was cleaning, she turned on the vacuum cleaner. It took me a while to catch on to this. It seemed every time I called her on a Saturday morning, I would hear the vacuum. She finally told me that her brain kicked into cleaning gear when the vacuum cleaner was on. Energy wasting for sure, but boy, did Maggie have one clean house. Scientists at MIT have now determined that the brain gives special processing to music. In fact, it hijacks all manner of brain functions to process it. You see, I told you it was distracting me, right? Well, by computationally analyzing brain scans on music, the neuroscientists discovered that we have a music center in the brain, which also calls upon other brain functions. And it doesn't matter if it's hip-hop or rock, country or bebop, the same activation centers get activated. If it's anything like music, this part of the brain is activated. Just as there is a different part, which processes words and the human voice, and we're just figuring out all kinds of things. So I sit in my car and drive, listening to audiobooks, while the music part of my brain sits dormant, or if not dormant, just ready for any signs of music. It does explain how that signature NPR audio mix that switches from voices talking to music and back again puts our brains on alert. Indeed, it gives you a completely different experience. When the only music you hear are familiar intros or outros, short branding pieces meant to signal the start or end of a program or a segment, no new synapses are firing here. The intent is to breed expectation, while the interspersed NPR audio takes you on a whole new journey every time. So listen to the music for me, if you will. My job uses words to bring visual pictures, insight, and comprehension into things we've not previously understood. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, we hear from the Consumer Technology Association and about the annual CES show in Las Vegas. CTA President Gary Shapiro tells us about disruptive technology. Then on Biotech Nation, one company's effort to treat NASH, NASH, also known as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and another company's strategic approach to treating cancer. First target, B-cell lymphomas. Gary Shapiro is the longtime president and CEO of CTA, the Consumer Technology Association, and he's the author of Ninja Innovation. Well, it's good to see you, and the very first thing I want to ask you about is driverless cars. It looks like they're going to make them work.
Absolutely. Every day we're getting closer. There's new announcements from existing companies. There's new companies coming in there. The technology is moving quickly, and we're making progress not only in the United States but around the world.
Now, is this some continuum from, you know, we're automatically parking a car, from cruise control, all of that? Or is this a completely different shift of technology to become a driverless car?
We are making progress already. We have adaptive cruise control. We have active collision avoidance. We have lane departure warnings, which are appearing in a lot of cars. Your steering wheel will vibrate if you go out of your lane. To the point, I got a new car recently and I was thrilled. I almost hit the car in front of me because I was looking at something and it actually braked for me, active collision avoidance. So this is a process. The good news for everyone is that right now we have about 35,000 deaths a year from car accidents, almost all of which are basically driver error of one type or another. Most of those should go away. That'll mean lower insurance premiums, which most Americans, I think, will be thrilled about. It'll also mean fewer deaths, fewer injuries, which is really, it's the tragedy which we will soon be able to control.
Now, this is not just around town. It's also high-speed driving. There's a whole lot of different levels here. Is it all going to be handled?
Eventually, when the whole fleet turns over, we will have pretty much driverless cars. Of course, I think there'll be some people would prefer a driver option, and they will have that. It may be limited to where. People may treat their cars the way some people think of their guns. You'll take it out of my hands. But we've just done some research, and we found out that most Americans are very excited about driverless cars. They're excited because of what it does for them in terms of safety, avoiding drunken drivers, what it does for our disabled and elderly population. It gives them freedom, and what it does for their insurance premiums. And plus, they have a whole bunch of other reasons. Some people look forward to taking that frustrating commuting time and turning it into something productive. Some people just like the access it provides. And it kind of ties in almost with the sharing society, the Ubers and Lyfts of the world. If you think about it, cars may become like shoes, where you just don't have one set of shoes. You got all these different sets, but you don't even have to buy them. With Uber and Lyft going driverless, if you need a big car, you could ask for a big car. If you want a small car, you could get a small car. And a lot of, especially younger people, are saying they don't even want to own cars then.
And when we were coming of age, it was like, well, your car defined you. You had to get a car.
Well, today your telephone defines you, because your telephone, your smartphone, is giving you the freedom that your car used to give you. If you could stay in contact with all your friends and provide immediate updates and learn about everything in the world, you are untethered and you are free with your phone. So that car doesn't provide a purpose anymore except perhaps for pure transportation. And let's be honest, if it's driverless and smart, it could do a lot better. And it could do it without worrying about whether you're drinking or impaired in any other way, or if you're falling asleep at the wheel. And you could do other things, including texting, because we've hit one thing with teenagers and others hard, is that texting while driving is very dangerous. And so this provides answers to a lot of the problems that we have. And it also provides problems for parking and for all the urban congestion we have. If you have driverless cars and a lot less car ownership, that car that people own, which sits not used 95% of the time, will become much better used. There'll be fewer of them, most likely, and they'll be greener with less congestion.
Now, my mother in her final years was in no shape to be driving cars, but darn it, she had an active driver's license, and she, you know, she'd show it to anybody. It's like, look, I could drive if I had to. So, you know, kind of that was a big deal. And then when friends of hers would lose their license, it was really traumatic. It's like there was some sensibility, but at that point in time, you couldn't go anyplace if you didn't have a license. Now, recently I saw that you wrote a commentary for the Wall Street Journal, and I didn't realize that in some states they're starting to pass laws. In some states, they're requiring you to have a driver's license to be in a driverless car, to be sort of there's this designated driver and you have to have a driver's license. Is that kind of where things are going?
Well, the states are going in different directions. Michigan and Arizona said you don't need a sentient driver ready to take over. California's gone the other way. California says you must have someone to take over. Now, what's interesting is that Google's done some work in this area, and they found that when they're employees tested driverless cars a little bit, they found that they would not pay attention, they wouldn't take over, they'd even fall asleep. So the reality is having a sentient driver be able to respond quickly enough in a potentially life threatening situation is not really that great to rely on. And it's also something, if you think of, you know, the disabled community, they really want this and they feel excluded by our present transportation. They have to rely on other people. So this is something where I think where we are going in the direction is we cannot rely on humans to be the driver that takes over. Just the way we don't in some of the automated trains and things like that. There are fail-safe mechanisms that could be put in. And there's also a disagreement, actually, even among car companies. Ford, their CEO, Mark Fields, announced recently that in 5 years, Ford will be mass-producing cars without a steering wheel, without ability for a driver to take over. Mercedes-Benz has said they'll always allow a driver to take over in their cars. Now, Ford may be a little bit quick on that, and Mercedes may be a little, in terms of the long term, I don't think that's what the world will look like in 30 or 40 years. The reason to take out the driver capability, in part, is you could take a lot of the cost out of making a car. And so you can make driverless cars more accessible. They could be cheaper. So it's not only the insurance which could be cheaper, it's the car itself which will be cheaper.
Now, I saw something new on your website, at least it was new to me. CTA now has an innovation scorecard. What is that?
Well, we are really about innovation. That is what we focus on. It's our mission is to make sure innovation is something which can happen, and it's good because it moves mankind along and it'll solve the most basic problems in the world. And part of it is how governments respond to innovation. Do they have the right recipe or ingredients necessary for innovation? And we realize not only does our own government, the United States government, different than other countries, and we've done a lot of things right, but states are starting to distinguish themselves. So we started looking at factors that we consider important. What kind of broadband penetration do they have? What kind of STEM degrees? How are the universities doing? What kind of tax policy and worker flexibility policy do they have? And we're looking at things now such as, are they favorable to new forms of innovation like Airbnb, like Uber and Lyft? Do they welcome them or do they try to protect status quo businesses? And one of them is clearly and will be how friendly they are towards driverless cars. Are they embracing them? Or are they responding to those that are seeking to protect existing interests?
Well, I saw that there were four levels. You could be an innovation champion, and then the next level down is innovation leader, and then innovation adopter, and then modest innovator. Actually, I saw this map of the United States with varying levels of blue instead of red and blue. It's like, did Hillary win? And no, none of the states voted for Trump. You know, so you have it visually, so you could see exactly. You know, the more intense it is, the higher innovation readiness, I guess you would assign to them.
Absolutely. We had 10 factors, 7 of them very objective, like ones I mentioned, 3 a little bit more subjective. And it didn't go along whether they're Republican or Democrat at all, that it was irrelevant to us. What was relevant were the policies they had. And we found, for example, everyone says, oh, California is the most innovative state. And truly, by some measures, it is. But by other measures, frankly, it's horrible. It has regulations which are choking. It has a huge tax rate that's discouraging. And some of those factors—
It got an F in one of the categories.
The regulations it has, when the governor vetoed legislation which would have required that regulatory decisions be based on scientific fact, it really was, we found, very discouraging, because instead they basically were using non-scientific methods and old data, 10, 20, 30 years old. Now, in my world of technology and personal electronics, if you're using data 20 or 30 years ago, for example, for regulating energy efficiency in a TV set, you're talking about cathode ray tubes. And that's exactly what they are doing and continue to do. Plus, they have a very high tax rate. It's very difficult to get the workers you want in California. There's a lot of them, but there's great things here. There's no question. The world looks to Silicon Valley. I hear that around the world. But there are pockets of innovation all around this country in so many different ways. And there's great things going on with entrepreneurship, because we're living in an era now where anyone with a broadband connection and a computer or a tablet could actually start up a global business. That's what innovation is about.
Now, one of these categories I found was pretty interesting, supports drones.
Yeah, so drones is a great new category, and states are taking different approaches. Now, this is one where when the plane was first introduced, there's this great Supreme Court case which said that you own your land all the way up to the sky. Well, the Supreme Court said, no, you don't. And it became the federal government was regulating it. And I think that after a very, very slow start, the federal government has stepped in and said, this is too important for so many things. You know, obviously, when we hear drones, we think about bad things and killings abroad. We're not talking about that. We're talking about commercial.
I'm just looking up and saying, what a beautiful sky. What is all this stuff over here?
Well, they're going to be look more like birds, and maybe they'll make bird-like sounds. But what they could do is they find missing children. They keep security around places like prisons. They do all sorts of different things. They help provide medicine. But now people are also using them to take videos of themselves doing various sports. GoPro just announced something where they have their own drone use and doing all sorts of really cool things. There's a tremendous number of products, and literally millions of Americans want to have these things to play with, actually.
So we're going to actually find out how we want to use them, where we want to use them, and where we don't, because we don't permit everything anywhere anyway.
That's true, but we may want them, for example, in cities for rooftop-to-rooftop deliveries to help avoid congestion on the ground. Now, those of us that live in cities are different than those that live in rural areas. In rural areas, they have huge benefits for agriculture and farming and determining whether how your crops are doing, whether they need water, all sorts of things that are radically changing farming. But in the cities, there is, of course, a concern that what's going to happen? We have all these drones flying around. Is this going to be bad? And I think we're very far from that. The rules now are that you have to have line of sight for the drone operator. The drone operator has to know what they're doing and be certified. I mean, there's all sorts of things the federal government is doing. But we will continue to advance. And by the way, soon we'll combine a driverless car with the drone, and we'll have the Jetsons with our flying cars that we all dream about when we're stuck in traffic.
There you go. Get me out of here.
Already a prototype from Eastern Europe. There'll be more and more coming, these little vehicles that allow you to fly around and go where you want.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Gary Shapiro. He's a longtime president and CEO of CTA, the Consumer Technology Association, which produces the annual CES show in Las Vegas. You know him from his book, Ninja Innovation. I'm always fascinated by the projections that CTA comes up with. And you don't do things like, let's project what's going to happen in 2025 or 2040. You know, like we'd have to catch up with you and say, were you right or not? You project things like next year. You know, and that's, the rubber meets the road there. Now, you project, and I say you, and I love it. You're just the president and CEO of CTA.
I do review the projections. We have a great meeting with our market research team, and we go over what's likely to happen. We have intense discussions.
Well, you say that almost 48 million wearable devices in the U.S. In 2016. That's this year. So obviously that was done. That's up 40% from the year before. So 1 out of 5 of us are going to walk around with wearable devices.
Or some of us will be wearing 2. We walk the walk and talk the talk. We've had some incredible, I guess I'll use the name, Fitbit challenges in our office. We give each of our employees one, and they've really changed behavior. Not always positively, because some of us are up late at night to help support our team, moving around. And yes,
we're gaming the system.
I don't know about gaming the system. We're trying to, I know there's different ideas that people have come up with. You could put it on your, we've learned you could put it on your ankle and you get biking credit that way. Uh-huh. I wouldn't call that gaming the system. Some people seem
I
to
was
have
just a, waving my hand here.
Some people seem to have shorter gaits. And we have, the winning team had 20,000 steps a day and I was on that team. And it was a burden that I don't want to go through again, frankly. It's, I lost a lot of. We had our Olympic challenge. But no, definitely people love these devices. They are making a difference. They're increasingly providing more information about our sleep, about our heart rate, about our health. When they can start looking at our blood for diabetics, it will absolutely be huge. And they're, I just got mine linked into my scale this weekend. God knows why my wife insisted on it, but it's now we'll know how much I weigh, as well as my BMI, my body mass index, which has me borderline obese for some reason, and also other things about me that I don't understand. But huge amounts of information. And at some point soon, that'll be useful not only by doctors, which are using it in different ways. They're being used in emergency rooms or looking at a person's Fitbit to see what their heart rate has been. Car accidents you could see, but also in terms of aggregating data, in terms of predictive intelligence, so you can know whether you're likely to get sick. If your car seat tells you you're about to get sick, maybe you will do something differently and get that sleep or have that chicken soup or take that vitamin C. So we're just at the beginning of this, but definitely wearable devices are big.
Now, wearable devices, of course, are new things on the Internet of Things. How's the Internet of Things doing?
The Internet of Things is going swimmingly well. As we hook up more and more things, whether it's our lighting system or our shades or increasingly soon our cars, of course, already GM, most GM cars through OnStar are hooked up to Detroit, and they know wherever an OnStar car has had a car accident or the bag has deployed, the collision bag, the airbag, and you get a lot of information from that. And they also know if the car is likely to break. So clearly the industrial, if you will, the business-to-business internet is where a lot of this will start. But in the home, we're starting to use it for different things to adjust our environment for us and gather information. But there's also other information, which is very valuable. There's a company which is taking information from the internet in hospitals and figuring out how people are treated and aggregating their data and figuring out what works and what doesn't work. So there, if you can aggregate all that information, because every hospital has an intranet, you could get all the major devices are hooked up to that. You could correlate with what the malady of the patient is, and then you can figure out what their treatment was and whether it worked or not. It's starting with hearts, but it could be used soon for brain tumors, for breast cancer, for all sorts of ailments. And we're going to advance humankind pretty quickly with these Internet of Things products.
Now, CTA has something called the Disruptive Innovation Council. What's that?
So one of the reasons we changed our name to the Consumer Technology Association is because it's not just about hardware products. It's about how technology is making a difference in the consumer experience. And we realized we were attracting companies like Airbnb and Uber and Pandora and Boingo Wireless, who will be our new chairman shortly, and so many others that are out there trying to change things in a huge way, affecting literally millions of people around the world. So we also found these people were fighting a status quo, these companies. They were up against hotels or taxi drivers or the music industries or established ways of doing business where someone had a revenue stream. They're very comfortable, and they didn't want a competitor to come to the market. So for all of them, they liked our message, which is that change is good, that you must innovate or die, that you must do things differently because that is what we do as Americans, and we're so good at it. We challenge the status quo. We're always up there pushing. We always have a better idea, whether it's our genetic makeup or the fact that we come from an immigrant population or whatever it is, our First Amendment. All these factors mix up in a way we're the most diverse country in the world. We know how to disagree with each other respectfully, usually outside of presidential
Everybody
politics.
But Trump.
Right? But we can come up with great solutions. And the world embraces them. Now, other governments, not so much. What we're seeing in Europe lately is a lot of attack on major American companies, whether it's Apple or Google or otherwise. And they're saying, we know our citizens love what you do, but we're going to try to get your taxes back. We're going to challenge you in so many different ways. We're going to create all sorts of new rules so it's more difficult for you to do business here so Europeans have a chance. I don't think that's healthy. I think, you know, the world is a wonderful marketplace. anyone could compete, but let's focus on the value of innovation and all the benefits it will provide.
We were just talking about the innovation scorecard, and one of the elements, which I'm very impressed with, is welcomes new business models. And I have to say, I will go around, and if I look at some of these people on your list, Airbnb, Expedia, Google, GoPro, Uber, Lyft, Yelp, Snapchat, TripAdvisor. I mean, this is just a list in your council of people who came up with brand new business models. It is very difficult for me to go out and talk to very smart people who are very responsible, and they don't get the new business model. They just don't get it. So they're objecting to things they don't understand. I'm hearing objections. It's like, well, that's just not true, and that's just not true. So in addition to cutting into the food chain, as you were saying, you know, it's a little difficult to understand these business models. We haven't seen them before.
Well, Americans are delighted, as are others around the world, with these new opportunities. My family, we had to come to California for a wedding that my wife and my son were in. And we looked at staying in the hotel with a wedding. You know, we had five people, actually. And if we got three rooms or even two, it would have been $2,000 a night. We didn't want to spend that. So instead, we got a Airbnb nearby for, you know, one quarter of the cost. It was delightful. So a lot of these things I've experienced myself. I mean, who doesn't love a lot of these, whether it's TripAdvisor or Pandora or Lyft or Uber or Airbnb? These are products and services which have made life better for us, and they've created new jobs. What we're seeing in this economy is that a lot of females are overrepresented in a sense compared to taxi cab drivers and others, and females overwhelmingly give a reason that they like the flexibility it provides in terms of their working hours. Also, minority males are overrepresented as Uber and Lyft drivers. That's jobs that they're taking. Now, there are discussions going on. Is this fair? Is it, you know, they're not treated as employees? Where's their future? Where's their health care? And those are good discussions to have. But in the meantime, though, we're creating essentially 50,000 new jobs a month in the United States. And then the other side of the equation, let's take Airbnb. If you own a home, as my brother did, and can't afford the mortgage, this was his savior. This allowed him to keep his home where otherwise he would have had to sell it. And he was perfectly happy. He was a genial sort of guy who meets a lot of people and friends with them. It works for both sides of the equation. And if you go back a little bit and you think about why the United States was funded, were created rather, it was created because people were wanted to be able to do business with each other without the government being involved. They didn't want this huge tax from abroad, from Britain, and being told what to do. And if you look at the Brexit vote even, which a lot of people interpret a lot of different ways, and they're probably all right, my theory is that Brits didn't want to be told what to do. They've been an island nation for years, and they just wanted out. They didn't have the same currency. And now what they're doing is they're saying, look, we don't want to have a regulation on what a banana's curve looks like, and which is the kind of thing they were facing. So the trend of the world is clearly to embrace these new business models. And the state governments and the federal governments that don't embrace them in part incur the wrath of their citizens, as they should.
I've been speaking with Gary Shapiro, the president and CEO of the Consumer Technology Association. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available on iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, Conatus Pharmaceuticals and their effort to treat NASH, that's NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. And Sutro Biopharma tells us about their strategic approach to treating cancer. First target, B-cell lymphomas. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Gary Shapiro, the president and CEO of CTA, the Consumer Technology Association, which produces the annual CES show each January in Las Vegas. I really did get a picture reading some of the CTA material about what it means to have the Internet of Things. And one of the things I didn't realize is, in terms of natural disasters, all of these wearable devices, all of these iPhones and you know, Android phone, all of these things kick in. We have far more information now. One of the examples was the 2014 Napa earthquake. Because of all of these devices, we had a lot more information about the extent of it that we never had before.
Absolutely. So the Jawbone users around San Francisco, they were jolted awake by that, and Jawbone immediately knew they could map out how far that earthquake went by the number of people that were jolted awake. That's the kind of information that I don't know how we would get it before then, but now it's...
We didn't have it. You literally would call up the U.S. Geological Survey and say, I'm here, and it lasted this long, and,
right.
And they start compiling the data.
This is tremendous information. And think about what we could do with cars, for example. Of course, San Francisco doesn't get snow and ice, but imagine if the car in front of you and all the cars aggregate their information for the weather forecasters or for people behind them, that you hit a slick patch or that your windshield wipers are going, they've hit rain ahead of you. You could have micro-localized information. You can know whether your car went over a pothole or is in a car accident ahead of you and you're hitting fog, and all of a sudden you'll be alerted. The value
Think about that. Three people hit the pothole. The system knows there's a pothole there, or skid on ice. The system knows there's an ice patch there. We never knew that before.
And this will be life-saving information. It will also obviously allow the government to fix things quicker and deal with situations quicker, but it also could provide immediate information, and it will in the future, to those that are driving behind you. You know, there's these multi-car collisions when it's foggy. There's all sorts of – you could see the videos on YouTube. I mean, literally 30, 40, 50 cars hit each other because they just can't see. They don't know. There's no way of knowing. There will be a way of knowing in the future.
All right, you got to tell us, what's coming up at CES 2017?
First week of January in Las Vegas, CES 2017, the show where innovation comes to marketplace. We'll have over 170,000 trade people coming, including 50,000 people from abroad, and over 3,600 companies exhibiting, and almost 2.5 million net square feet of exhibit space. But what are the technologies? Well, you'll see a lot on driverless cars. You see drones. You see wireless health. And, of course, 3D printing. And we have a special area that I love, the most buzz, called Eureka Park. We'll have 600 companies there that are startups. And they'll be displaying their wares. And for 4 days, they will, like, drink out of a fire hose and get input, investors, buyers, partners, all sorts of people they want to do business with. It's a great event because it gets everyone focused on innovation together in one city at one time. And everyone comes away inspired and with ideas for their business.
And I'll tell you, there's just so much going on. You kind of come out of there with, I think I've just been to the spa for 6 days in a row, and they did. It's just like your mind is blown. It's an amazing.
It's amazing because it gives you hope for the future of the world. Because you see products there, which you're talking about agriculture and clean water and health and healthcare. We are moving so quickly. And of course, now with all this data we're gathering, it's a matter of coming up with new services and products and measuring it. And it is so inspiring.
Well, Gary, such a pleasure. Come back. See me anytime.
Oh, I love it. I love being here. You're the best. Thank you.
My guest today is Consumer Technology Association President Gary Shapiro. More information on CTA and the upcoming CES 2016 show in Las Vegas can be found on the web at cta.tech. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, one company's effort to treat NASH, N-A-S-H, also known as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and another company's strategic approach to treating cancer. First time out, B-cell lymphomas. Dr. Steve Mento is the CEO of Conatus Pharmaceuticals in San Diego. I asked him to start by describing NASH, the official name for non-alcoholic steatohepatitis.
Well, it's a consequence of, or one of the things that's linked to obesity. And really, one of the consequences of having a lot of fat in your system is fat builds up in your liver. And that fat in your liver can lead to inflammation, can lead to fibrosis, can lead to liver damage and liver disease.
This is progressive. I mean, you just start with, well, you're starting to lay in some fat, but ultimately it gets really rough in your liver.
You know, and it's like everything else, it doesn't happen in everybody. So if you look, if you took 100 patients that were obese and had fat in their liver, only about 20% of those or 20 of those patients would progress to what's called NASH. And really it's just, it's the fat in the liver and then inflammation in the liver associated with that. And so now you have, out of that original 100, you have 20 patients that have NASH, the disease that everybody's been hearing about, inflammation of the liver due to fat. But only 20% of those patients go on to have fibrosis, the next stage disease. So now you take 100, you go to 20, now you're down to four. Four patients that have really serious disease. Fibrosis is when you start putting fibers down in the liver that basically start clogging the filter. One of the things that your liver does is filter a ton of blood. About 25% of your entire blood flow goes through your liver every couple of minutes.
Every couple of minutes, right.
So, you know, that fiber clogs up the filter, and if you're clogging up the filter, you get things back up and you start having problems. And then ultimately that leads to the final stage, which is cirrhosis, which is when the filter's kind of clogged and you're in trouble.
And isn't it palpably different then at that point?
The liver actually gets hard. And one of the ways that hepatologists can diagnose grossly whether a patient is kind of at that late stage, they palpate the liver and they can actually feel the nodules and feel that it's hard. Right. That's exactly right.
Now the liver has a tremendous regenerative capability.
Correct. That's exactly right. And what we're trying to do with our drug is give it a chance. Our drug, the way it works is it treats the consequences of the damaging events. So in NASH, it's fat in the liver. If it's viral infections, it treats the consequences of that and kind of stabilizes that and stops that damage from going on. And as you point out, the liver is a remarkable organ. It can repair itself. And we actually have trials ongoing right now to prove that the drug can actually visibly show improvement. But also functionally show improvement.
Now, let's talk about what exactly your drug is doing.
Sure. This drug is a drug that I won't go into detail on the mechanism, but basically what it does is stop liver cells from dying due to the damage around that. And think about that. If your liver cells are dying, they're not doing their job. If it keeps the cells healthy, basically, then they can continue to do their job and they're not going to basically get clogged up and have the filter go bad on you.
Now, you've got several trials ongoing here.
Right. And this last year has been a big one for us. So we had three readouts of clinical trial data, all in patients with cirrhosis. The first two were in patients that had cirrhosis due to anything. It could have been to alcohol or viruses or fat in the liver due to NASH. So we think the mechanism's powerful enough that it could treat any kind of cirrhosis. But then through interactions with the FDA, FDA likes things crisp and clean. So they said focus on one cause of cirrhosis, and we focused on NASH. So the last trial readout, really just last month, showed that we were able to, in only 3 months of dosing in patients with cirrhosis due to NASH, show functional improvement in their liver. They could get rid of toxins better, and they could synthesize the proteins you need, for example, to clot your blood better after only 3 months of treatment.
How do you measure that?
You know, it's the other advantage of going into patients with cirrhosis is that the things that we look at are what hepatologists, physicians use every day to monitor their patients. So there's a blood pressure your liver is called, or high blood pressure your liver is called portal hypertension, and it's the vein that feeds the liver. So there's a process that you can actually measure that, and that's what physicians use every day to decide whether or not there's a problem. Is the filter clogged? That kind of thing. It's called HVPG.
Look at the pressure.
Right. Look at the pressure. And then to measure function, there's a test called MELD score, M-E-L-D, or model for end-stage liver disease. And it's three laboratory parameters thrown into an equation that spits out a number, and that's what physicians use every day to position patients on the transplant list. So if your MELD score is under 15, you don't qualify for a transplant. If it's 15 or above, you can qualify. And the higher the number is, the poorer your liver function is. The third one that we measured is called Child-Pugh score, and that's a measure of function. How is your liver doing in getting out bad stuff and in synthesizing good things. And it's a measure, again, that physicians use every day to categorize your liver as having mild impairment, moderate impairment, or severe impairment. Now, on all three of those endpoints in the two trials I just described, we showed improvement 3 for 3. The other thing important about those endpoints, they've already been identified by the FDA as validated surrogate endpoints. So those are endpoints we can use in pivotal studies. Already have a lot of data demonstrating what goes wrong as they increase. Now we're showing data that what goes right when they go down.
I think what's really fascinating here is these studies were people who were tremendously sick.
Right. They had symptoms.
We're talking full on fibrotic cirrhosis.
That's exactly right.
Really tough. Was there any change in palpability, or is like it's just too early?
Too short in that. We do have longer term studies where we're actually looking for physical changes in the liver. Here we're looking kind of like at the output, the functional measures, the laboratory parameters. But I mean, these patients are symptomatic. They have ascites. They can't clot their blood real well. They are on the verge of really a stage where either they get a liver transplant or they're going to die due to their liver cirrhosis.
Now, are you going to keep those people on board, or they're done?
In the trials that we have just done, they're done. But in the trials that we have planned, we're actually addressing that. There'll be a rollover phase. So the two trials we have planned to go, hopefully we can use those to actually get the drug approved. Both of those will start this year or early next year. We'll have the patients on the drug for 6 months and then roll them over for an additional 18 months or longer so that they'll have benefit of the drug for the long haul. And the reason why we do it like that is you can get a drug approved based on those endpoints I talked about, those surrogate endpoints. But what the regulators, FDA here and EMA in Europe, want to see is, well, if you reduce portal hypertension, does that mean a year from now these patients don't need a liver transplant or they don't get ascites or they don't? So they want to see clinical outcomes. So it's not just us being good guys to give the patients a chance to get better. It's also a practical component of proving that what we see in those markers, those early surrogate markers, actually translates to clinical benefit on the patients.
So if I may, it's like the first portion is answering some very specific questions.
Correct.
And then the rest of it is what we expect to be asked down the line.
Exactly.
So that they don't come back and say, we've got to start again. Well,
that's
now
right.
We've got to run it for 18 months.
So
now
we're past
have
that.
18 months.
Yeah, we're past that now. We're at the stage now where we want to do the trials that are going to lead to approval. And a component of that will be keeping the patients on drug. They won't have to walk away.
And these are infusions?
No, this is an oral drug. Sorry. Oral pill twice a day.
Oral pill twice a day.
Yep.
And you figure that this will go – this is for life? They'll take this?
Really good question. I think it's going to depend. So if you look at cirrhosis in the States right now, over half of that's due to alcohol consumption. All right? So you take away the alcohol, you know, presumably patients could take the drug until their liver is repaired and then not have to take it anymore. Patients that have viral infections that are now cured with some of the new drugs, they still have cirrhosis. Again, one of the trials we have ongoing right now is to see whether or not – how long do they have to be on our drug in order so they don't need it anymore, so that they can reverse the cirrhosis. In NASH, it's a different situation. As long as they have the obesity and the other contributing factors, the pressure, the insult's still there, they probably have to take the drug in order to keep their liver healthy. So it depends on whether the insult's still there or whether – the insult's been eliminated either through an antiviral therapy or basically diet and exercise.
I think, oh golly, you just lost 100 pounds. I'll be darned.
That's right.
But I think this is also really important. The whole idea is that we continue to watch. We continue
Correct.
To strategize.
Correct.
And the opportunity – people are working on all kinds of things right. that can come into play.
It buys time. At minimum, it gives time for these patients that are running out of time.
Steve, great news on the phase 2 trials. Please come back. Keep us updated, won't you?
I hope to see you in San Diego next year.
Dr. Steve Mento is the CEO of Conatus Pharmaceuticals. More information is available at conatuspharma.com. That's Conatus, C-O-N-A-T-U-S, conatuspharma.com. There's been a lot of work done in the field of cancer treatments in recent years. I asked Bill Newell, the CEO of Sutro Biopharma, to bring us up to date.
Well, I think most people, when they think about cancer therapy, think about chemotherapy. And really, that was the first generation of drugs designed to kill tumor cells. Now, the problem with chemotherapy is that it also kills healthy cells. And so there is a limit to how much chemo you can give a patient. And we know that the more chemotherapy that you can give a patient, the better the outcome for the patient will be. But the toxicity of these drugs really prevents them from being fully effective in eradicating the tumor cells. And so ultimately, they become ineffective and the tumor progresses.
And this is part of why, with the healthy cells, that's part of why we lose our hair and all of those side effects?
That's correct. There are certain toxicities associated with the chemotherapies. Some of them can be managed with other drugs that have been developed in the industry. But in the main, chemotherapy has not proven to be effective in curing cancer. It can prolong a patient's life, but there's a cost to the patient in terms of quality of life. And that's really one of the limiting factors of that approach to therapy. It's still the mainstay of cancer therapy, but there are other new and emerging therapies that are trying to build on that and use the antibodies that have also been developed as a second generation of cancer therapy to go after tumor cells and try and disrupt them.
Now, while we're developing new treatments, we've actually learned a lot about how cancer operates. It's different than we thought about 10 years ago, even.
The understanding of the tumor microenvironment has vastly improved over the last decade to 15 years. And we know that tumor cells do not just stay the same. They're not homogeneous all the time. They mutate, and therefore drugs that may be effective at one stage of cancer may cease to be effective as the tumor becomes a different type of cell and requires a different type of intervention.
So we have this complex cancer with many different kinds of cells. This is a hard challenge.
It's probably one of the biggest challenges in medicine that we have today. And we've made great strides over the last 15 to 20 years, but we're still at the early stages of the battle. Our objective at the end of the day is to turn cancer into a chronic disease. I'd like to think in our lifetime we could achieve that. I think the opportunity to eradicate cancer completely is probably many, many generations away. But if we can turn it into a chronic disease, then I think we're able to help patients manage through cancer the way we help them manage through other chronic diseases. And then we're working on improving the quality of life that they have while they're battling their cancer.
Now, what's Sutro done? What's its focus?
Sutro is focused on antibody-drug conjugates. Now, these are molecules that take the best of the chemotherapies, and they combine them with the best of antibodies so that you get a targeted tumor attack. Think of that as a smart bomb going after the tumor cell. You get an antibody that preferentially recognizes the tumor cell. And attached to that antibody is a warhead, a chemotherapy agent, but more potent than the type of chemotherapy agents that exist today. You would not be able to give that warhead as you would give traditional chemotherapy because it would kill the patient. But in the micro dose that you attach to the antibody, it goes directly to the tumor cell, and then the warhead gets released within the tumor cell, and it does its damage, killing the tumor cell.
It's gone. Now, let me ask you this. I think with the antibody, it's the whole idea. It's like, well, how does this antibody get developed? How does it find just the tumor cell? How's that relationship evolve?
That's a very elaborate scientific process. What you're really looking for at the discovery stage is an antibody that ideally preferentially recognizes the tumor cell. And there are a lot of techniques that we have for identifying those antibodies and screening them. Once that antibody has been identified, you're able to show that it does not associate itself to healthy tissue and healthy cells, but goes preferentially to the tumor cell. You do that.
Step one.
Yes, you do that through in vitro work. You do that, in the lab, and then ultimately you try and confirm that in animal models as well. Getting the antibody right is only part of the equation, though, for an antibody drug conjugate. Each antibody is different, and if depending on whether you're going after a breast tumor cell or a pancreatic tumor cell or a colon tumor cell, you're going to be looking for different antibodies that are going to be recognizing those tumor cells. And so that's a very complicated process. Once you've got that antibody, then you have to identify the right agent to attach to that antibody, and you have to identify the right method of attaching that agent to the antibody. If you don't attach it properly, when the antibody drug conjugate gets introduced into the patient's system, it may go to the tumor cell, but it may have lost the warhead before it gets to the tumor cell. If that happens, you get off-target toxicity, which will limit the effectiveness of the agent. So you have to find the right combination of antibody, linker warhead, and the right site, and make sure you've got a homogeneous molecule so that you can identify the appropriate therapeutic for the patient.
Well, even if you can link what we're calling the warhead here to the right antibody, could you have a too weak warhead, or could you have one that doesn't actually work the way you would hope it would?
That's one of the tricks in this battle against cancer. You have to identify the right warhead to associate with the right antibody. There are a couple of classes of warheads that are attached to antibody-drug conjugates that have been approved by the FDA, but there are only a couple, and there are many other types of warheads that are under development. And what we at Sutro believe we want to do is to identify the right warhead for the right antibody for the right tumor. And if you can do that, then you make certain that you get a powerful enough warhead for the antibody drug conjugate that you're making, and that you don't end up damaging healthy cells in the process. And that's it's a trial and error process that typically most pharmaceutical companies spend years developing one single antibody drug conjugate, because most companies have to develop an antibody, and then they have a method of conjugating the linker and the warhead to the antibody that is relatively nonspecific. In other words, there are lots of locations in which that linker and warhead might be attached to the antibody. And at the end of the day, they produce a mixture of antibody-drug conjugates that has what is known as a drug-antibody ratio to it, typically around 4, which means that there are 4 warheads on any individual antibody. Now, in that mixture, some of those warheads are in various locations that are different from other locations. And in that mixture, an antibody might have no warheads, in which case it would not be effective to kill the tumor cell. It might have as many as 8 or 9 warheads attached because of the conjugation method, and that would make it too toxic. But on average, there are a number of antibodies with drugs associated with them that are effective, but there are a number that are ineffective or overly toxic. What we attempt to do is to identify the exact placement location for a warhead on an antibody and make certain that it is not associated with that antibody in any place other than the place that we specify. So if we decide that we want a drug-antibody ratio of 2, we have one location in either the heavy or light chain, and since there are 2 of them, you end up with a drug-antibody ratio of 2 that we specifically conjugate our linker warhead to. If we decide that a drug-antibody ratio of 4 is better because we want more warhead of that particular type going to the tumor cell, then we have 2 locations. Again, it could be heavy or light chain, or one location in each of the 2 chains to attach our linker warhead to. So it's a really complicated design metric that you have to go through. Now, we make our antibodies in less than 24 hours, and so we can make many different antibodies with many different attachment sites, and we can compete many different linker warhead combinations. And so in the span of 6 months to a year, we're able to winnow down a large number of trial and error antibody drug conjugates to a discrete number that are most likely going to be the candidates that we advance into clinical development.
So where are you with all of your candidates in terms of, you know, phase 1, phase 2, phase 3?
We're at the very exciting cusp of having a candidate that we've nominated to take into the clinic next year. So our first antibody drug conjugate, we expect to put into phase 1 clinical trials in the latter part of next year.
That's safety and toxicity.
That will be, well, in cancer, you do your phase 1 trials with cancer patients, as you know, and so we'll be looking at the safety profile of the molecule, but we'll also be working on getting the dosing regimen right. Now, cancer trials have evolved from when I first got into the industry, where you did a very small patient set for safety purposes, even though you were trying to treat cancer patients, and you hoped you saw a signal in some tumor type that would then inform you about a larger study 1B study is what we call it, or maybe an early phase 2 study to explore the efficacy in a larger patient population with a particular tumor type. Today, we tend to think of larger phase 1 studies where you have a number of cancer patients with different tumors, and you're working to establish the appropriate dosing schedule, check the safety parameter, but now you've got enough information that you can envision a second cohort after you know what your dose is, where you're actually doing an expanded phase 1 study to try to prove in principle at phase 1 that you are having the desired effect on a tumor cell. And that's the sort of design that we're talking about starting next year. It's a design that, for our purposes, could have up to 150 patients enrolled in it in phase 1, which is a significant phase 1 study.
It's almost like we're expecting more out of phase 1. It's like we're still safe. We know we're safe. We're changing doses. We're changing patients. But we're expecting more information out of there. And I would say that's the advantages would be time and money.
We have a better understanding of the molecules that we're taking into the clinic, and particularly with these antibody drug conjugates. We have a lot of information about how the antibody binds to the tumor cell, how the antibody drug conjugate gets internalized, and how the warhead that we've designed specifically for that antibody drug conjugate actually operates to kill the tumor cell. And we've chosen the right warhead. So we know what to monitor early on in the clinical development work that we do, and we're able to really get a lot of bang for our buck. And the advantage of being able to do a study that's larger than we used to do is that you're able to really get a signal for the patient population much earlier. And cancer patients need many new therapies. And the earlier that we can identify the right cancer therapeutic that might work for them, the better off everyone is going to be.
And the drug you're going into phase 1 with, what target cancer or cancers are you looking at there?
We're going after hematological malignancies, so B-cell related cancers. And that's an area where there's been a number of advances in the field, but there's still a significant unmet medical need. Patients who are on current therapies don't really get a break from the current therapies, and we'd like to offer a therapy that can be used in combination with other therapies, but then give the patient some time off from their other cancer therapies so that they can get the best quality of life for themselves and their families.
Bill, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back, see us.
I'd like that. Thank you very much for having me today.
Bill Newell is the CEO of Sutro Biopharma. More information is available on the web at sutrobiopharma.com. That's Sutro, S-U-T-R-O, sutrobiopharma.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.